I want to speak about a very difficult parish in the Torah, this week's Sedra, and give you my perspective on it, and I want to add to what I've said in the past, not here necessarily, a whole new addition that'll come at the end. But first we'll do what I normally have said over years, and the addition is to just broaden and enhance it. Let's start with some questions. You're all familiar with the Rashi in the beginning of this week's Sedra, by Yisrotzitzu, Habonim Bekirba, Rivka is pregnant, and the children are fighting within her, and she doesn't know what's going on, unusual. And the Rashi says, it's a Medrash, whenever she passed by a place of Avodah Zarah, Esav wanted to go out. Whenever she passed a place of Torah, Yaakov wanted to go out. So she went to find out what's going on. That Rashi, first of all, has some interesting side points to it. Let's get those out of the way before we get to the main fundamental problem with this Rashi. They ask, I understand why Esav wanted to go out to serve idolatry. He couldn't serve idolatry in his mother's womb. But Yaakov was learning with a malach. Why do you have to go out to learn Torah? He was learning Torah with a malach. So they say two answers to that. One is that you could be learning Torah and your Rebbe could be a malach, but your chavrusa is Esav, find another yeshiva. And secondly, they say, yes, Yaakov was learning Torah from a malach, spoon-fed. But the main thing of Torah is to get it on your own with effort, and that's why he wanted to go out and learn the Torah with his own effort. Okay, that's not the major thing here. The major thing is this Rashi is basically at odds with the whole foundation of Judaism, which is called free choice. People can be a tzaddik or a rasha based on their free choice. And it seems from over here that Yaakov and Esav were already predetermined, predestined, one to be a tzaddik, one to be a rasha, before they were born, when they were embryos. When did they have time to make free choice? It seems like Esav already was a rasha from the very beginning of his existence. And that is the antithesis of what Torah is all about, because if everything is predetermined, where's their place for mitzvahs? Another question. Less serious, but also a question. The Gemara says that Rebbe and Antoninus, who used to learn Torah together, Rebbe was a descendant, Rebbe Yudah Nossi, of Yaakov, and Antoninus was a descendant of Esav. He was a Roman Caesar. They used to learn Torah. Both of them were tzaddikim. And they had an argument, when does the Yetzer Hara become effective by a person? When does the Yetzer Hara enter a person? Rebbe said from conception, and Antoninus said from birth. And Antoninus brought a proof, and Rebbe agreed. So in the end, everybody agrees there is no Yetzer Hara before birth. If that's the case, why was Esav trying to go and serve Avodah Zarah if he had no Yetzer Hara? Next question. Okay, so we have these very, very different children. One who's an Oved Avodah Zarah, and one's a young budding Talmud Chacham before they're born. Rashi says that after they were born, until they became Bar Mitzvah, no one took notice of them. They both went to school, they both came home from school, and nobody really took notice of any differences between them until they became Bar Mitzvah. And then this one went out to the fields to hunt, and this one went to the Beis Medrash, and now people took note that there's differences. Now, they were so different before they were born. All of a sudden they're born, and the differences disappear for 13 years. And then the moment they're Bar Mitzvah, all of a sudden they come back. It's not normal. It doesn't happen like that. So what's going on over here? What happened to all those differences for 13 years? And then all of a sudden, the day they become Bar Mitzvah, they become that? What's it talking about? Okay, whatever, we have these two very different children, time they Bar Mitzvah. Esav is hunting all day, Yaakov is learning all day. Yitzchak has to give a bracha. He chooses to give the bracha to Esav. Doesn't he know that this son is in the fields all day and this one is in the Beis Medrash? Why does he want to give the bracha to the Talmud Chacham? Okay, what do we say? Well, Yitzchak thought both of his sons were Talmidei Chachamim, except this one was in the forest learning and this one was in the Beis Medrash learning. Didn't make Esav less of a tzaddik because he was out in the forest. He also was a tzaddik. Could be learning too in a field school or whatever. He's learning halachas, learning shita, learning whatever. Right. Possible. But it says that when Esav was 15, he committed 3 or 5 basic aveiras, serious aveiras. Amongst them, murder, Gili Arayis, Boal, Nara Murasa. He lived with a Nara Murasa and Avodah Zarah, or Kofar Be'ikr, denied God. Pretty serious things for a 15-year-old, for anybody. And Avram Avinu had to die that day so he shouldn't see Esav going off the derech. So it's pretty obvious that Esav was going off the derech, otherwise why did Avram Avinu have to die? And Yitzchak still wants to give him the brachas. Didn't Yitzchak know what was going on? Yitzchak is so naive, he doesn't know what's going on because he's blind in the house. So he didn't know what's going on. He's Yitzchak Avinu with Ruach HaKodesh. Doesn't know what's going on with his son Esav. And, okay, and I'll show you that Yitzchak did know that there was a difference between Yaakov and Esav. Because when Yaakov came in disguised as Esav, he tripped up twice. Once he said, Ki hikra Hashem elokech lefonai, he mentioned God's name. When Yitzchak asked him, how can you made it so fast? He said, because God made it quicker for me. So Yitzchak said, Esav never mentions God's name. This can't be Esav. Now here he knows he has a son who never mentions God's name. Far from being a tzaddik, bein adam lamakom, never mentions God's name, and he wants to give him the bracha. And there are answers to each of these questions. I want to give you an answer that answers all of them in one swoop. And the second thing that Yaakov mixed up on was that he said, please, yakum na'avi. And Yitzchak said, Esav, I never heard him say please or thank you in my life. This can't be Esav. Now here's a father, knows he has a son who's an uncouth boor who doesn't say please and thank you. He's not good between man and man. He doesn't mention God's name. He's not good between man and God, and he wants to give him the bracha and not the guy who sits in the base medrash. Why? Okay. Some reason Yitzchak didn't know, but Rivka knew. Right? She knew to the point where she had her son go and fool his father. Why don't you just go to her husband and say, listen, we got to talk about something. Right? You think that this Esav is a big tzaddik? I'm telling you, you're making a mistake. He's a Rosh. Why couldn't she talk to him? So the Ramban, I think the Netziv, says something similar, that she felt intimidated. Rivka was always intimidated by Yitzchak. The first time she saw him, she was so overawed, she fell off the camel. So she was so overawed of her husband, Pachad Yitzchak, right? The fear of her husband, awe. She couldn't talk to him. The only problem with that is, which really bothers me, I don't know if I don't have an answer, I don't know if they speak about it, I didn't have a chance to look into it again this year, is that in the end of the Sedra, Rivka goes to Yitzchak and she says in no uncertain terms, I don't want Yaakov to stay here, I want him to run away to my brother and stay there, whatever, and find a shidduch there. She knew how to talk to her husband, guns fine, tell him exactly what she wanted or whatever, and that, and he listened. So what changed? All of a sudden she got the courage. In the beginning of the Sedra she didn't. So why didn't you go and tell him? Why did she do this whole fiasco? Let me tell you 2 Rambams. Let's start now to answer all of this. The Rambam, the first Rambam is in Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Hei, Halacha Beis. The Rambam says the following. Al yavor b'machshavtecha dover zeh she'omrim tipshei umos ha'olam v'rov gol mei b'nei Yisrael. Don't entertain the thought. Don't let this thought pass through your mind that something that most foolish goyim say and many unfinished Jews. Shakadosh Baruch Hu gozer ala adam mitzchilas briyaso lios tzaddik arasha, that God decrees from a person's inception, from his very beginning of existence, whether he's going to be a tzaddik or a rasha. Ein hadover kein. It's not true. Ela kol adam roy lios li tzaddik. Every person can be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu, can't be a Navi like Moshe Rabbeinu, it could be a tzaddik, or a Rosh like Yeravim ben Nevat. He can be as wise and smart as he wants to be, or as stupid as he wants to be. O Rachamon, O Achzori, he can be merciful or cruel. O Kilai, O Shua, he can be stingy or generous. The Chain Shar Kol Adeos, all other midos, the same thing. The Ein Lo Mishi Chafu, no one forces him one way or the other. The Lo Gozerov, no one decrees on him one way or the other. The Lo Misha Moshkol, the Echad Mishni Adrochim, not only that, nothing pulls him to either side. Ela Hu Me'atzmo, what is the significant factor? Himself, midaito, his own das, his own ratzon, his own will, notala ezader shirtzei, free will, free choice, categoric, and it applies tzaddik rasha, midos, if you're going to be cruel or merciful, what's it called, stingy or generous and so on. Nothing decreed, nothing pulls you to either side. It's totally a matter of free choice. Balanced, objective free choice. Pretty clear Rambam. Now, one problem with this Rambam, even that wouldn't be another Rambam, that's even more problematic, only from this Rambam is quoting, basically, paraphrasing a Gemara in Nida. The Gemara says that when a person is conceived, a malach comes and takes that blastula, the first forming cells, and presents it before God. And he says, Tipa zu matehe ola. What's going to be with this forming embryo? Is he going to be strong or weak? Rich or poor? Handsome or ugly? But one thing, and smart or stupid? But one thing isn't said, tzaddik or rasha. It's not decreed whether he's going to be a tzaddik or a rasha, that's his free choice. But everything else is decreed, including chacham or tipesh, whether he's going to be smart or stupid. Yet the Rambam includes smart and stupid in what you have free choice to. Not what's decreed. He includes that together with merciful or cruel, stingy or generous, and smart or stupid. Now the Gemara says smart and stupid is decreed, and the Rambam says not. You could be as smart or as stupid as you want to be. So that's one question. The Rambam basically is paraphrasing the Gemara, but he got mixed up with one of the things in the category, put in the wrong category. But what's even more strange is the following Rambam. The Rambam says the following in Perek Aleph, Hilchos Deos, Halacha Aleph and Beis. Deos harbe yesh lekol echad ve'echad ne'odam, v'zu meshunu mizu rechokam imenu b'yosef. People have all different character traits, personality traits, from one extreme to another. And then the Rambam describes, there's certain people who are quick to anger and certain people who are very calm, cool, collected. Right, there are people who are very generous and people who are very stingy. People who are very merciful and people who are very cruel. And there is what's it called, from one extreme character trait to another, there are many gradations in the middle. Infinite amount of gradations. Somewhat cruel, a lot stingy, and so on. The Chol Hadeos, all of these traits, where do they come from? What would you expect the Rambam to say based on the other Rambam? They come from a person's free choice. The Yesh Mehem says, Deo Shein La'odim Itzkidas B'Yosso. Some of these are part of a person's nature from the time he's created. Okay? Which the Rambam said you should never entertain the thought. He says here, clearly, there are character traits, and the same character traits. Merciful, cruel, generous, stingy, same ones he mentioned over there. And here he says, some of them are from your very inception of when you're made. Some of them are not part of your intrinsic nature, but you have a predilection to them, predisposition to them. It's easier for you to adopt that midah. That's exactly against what the Rambam said. Nothing pulls you to one side or the other. Here the Rambam says you could be created with a nature that pulls you to one side. The Eishmeim Sheinim Lada Mechizbra. Some of them aren't from the beginning of your creation. Elalaman, you can learn it from other people, or you can adapt them yourself. But definitely, there are ones that are part of your very nature, which the Rambam said you're not allowed to say, and he's talking about the same thing: cruelty, merciful, same exact things. Here he says they are totally dependent on free choice. Here he says that some of them are already, what's it called, part of your nature, and or that you predispose to it. Yeah. This is in Hilchos Deos. Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph and Beis. So what's the answer here? The answer is simple. The Rambam is talking about two completely different things. In Hilchos Deis, the Rambam is talking about personality traits, character traits. And that's true. People are born with personalities. They're born with character. You're not born parav, and with your free choice, you develop your personality. You can enhance your personality. But you're born with a personality, with personality traits. Children are brought home from the hospital. Some of them are cool, calm, collected. Some of them are brats, and every little thing they cry for or whatever. An infant, a toddler, you send to nursery school. And he comes home without his shoes, without his mittens, without his pants. Where is it? I gave it to my friends. I gave his lunch away. He's a very generous little kid. And some kids come home with other people's mittens and pants and shoes and lunch. Why? Because that's their nature. This one has a generous nature. This one's a stingy nature. Some kids like to pull the wings off of flies or the legs off of ants. They're by nature cruel. And some kids are squeamish, right? They faint when they see, blood. So some people are one way, some people are a different way. That's a fact of life. You can't deny that. It's not that people with their free choice created these, because we're talking about little kids, little babies, little children. They're no free choice yet. They're children. So obviously this is part of their makeup. The Ribbono Shel Olam gives each person the kind of personality he needs to fulfill his purpose in this world. Everybody's a different neshama, and the neshama expresses itself different ways, with different personality traits. That's 100% true. But the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva is not talking about personality traits. He's talking about behavior, how you use those traits. And there he says, how you use it, your behavior, that is dependent on free choice. No personality trait intrinsically is good or bad. They're all part of it. They can be good, they can be bad. Using them can be good, using them can be bad. Suppressing them can be good, suppressing them can be bad. Depends on the circumstance. Example. Two people, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven, personality, he's more of a cruel person. Cruel meaning that, you know, he can rip the wings off of flies or whatever. He doesn't faint at the sight of blood. In fact, he enjoys it. And he's going to be a doctor. He enjoys it. And cutting people up and operating on them with a good intention. But he's noted towards that personality trait cruelty. Shimon is very squeamish, can't stand the sight of blood, right? Doesn't step on ants because he's very, very merciful. Okay. Now, both of them are walking down the street on their way to their little league baseball game. And a terrorist who just killed 200 people in cold blood is running away, and he trips in front of them, right on the floor. And he can't get up on himself, and he looks at them and he says, "Could you help me up? I'm late for my appointment of killing another 200 people in cold blood. Right? I may miss them, so could you help me up?" Now, you have a choice what to do. You can help the person up, be merciful, help him wipe himself off, and send him on his way to kill 200 more people. Or you can take the baseball bat in your hand and crush his skull and make mincemeat out of his brains. Okay? Now, helping him up and sending him on his way is ultimately very cruel, but it's an act of mercy. It's merciful on the spot. It's ultimately cruelty. But you don't have to be cruel to do this. You just have to be extra soft and merciful. To take a baseball bat and crush a guy's skull, right, is an act of cruelty, even though in the long run it's merciful. But you have to be cruel to be able to do that. You have to muster up a lot of cruelty at the moment to break that guy's skull. So what would be the proper behavior at that moment? Unless you belong to the ACLU, right, you probably will say, or some other leftist group, right, you probably will say that bashing this guy's brains in with a baseball bat would be the preferred behavior under the circumstances. So I, or Reuven, who has a predisposition to cruelty, is going to have an easy time of doing what's right. And Shimon, who has a predisposition to mercy, is going to have a hard time. But the proper behavior then would be cruelty. On the other hand, Now you bashed in this guy's brains, your baseball bats are full of blood, and you're walking down the street again, and a nice little old lady falls at your feet. Oh, I know what to do. The other guy says, baseball bat ready. No. Now the behavior is the opposite. This little lady, help her up. Don't bash your brains in, right? Now cruelty is wrong because the circumstances change. Now you're going to have an easier time, or Shimon's going to have an easier time, right, helping this lady up. And Reuven, who has this natia towards cruelty, is really holding himself back, like, you know, oh, I thought I'd get another chance of, you know, bashing somebody's brains in. Yesterday I got a man, now I got a woman, whatever, in any case. So, is cruelty bad or good? It depends what the circumstances are. Being stingy. If you're stingy and not giving somebody money for food because they're starving, stinginess is bad. But if you're stingy and you won't give somebody money to buy drugs and destroy his life, you're good. So no character trait is intrinsically bad or good. It depends on the circumstance. The Rambam says we are all a product of God's creation, and he instilled within us sometimes different character traits, 100%. Some of them are part of our very nature. But whether you use or suppress that character trait at any one time is up to you. You have full free choice. And therefore, the Rambam that says you have choice also to be wise or foolish is not the same thing the Gemara says. The Gemara says, chacham o tipesh. A chacham, a smart person or a stupid person. The Rambam says, chacham o sachal, a wise person or a foolish person. Two different things. What the Gemara is talking about is IQ. IQ is for sure decreed. People are born with a certain IQ. They can maybe enhance it a little bit, but if you're born with a 50 IQ, you're not going to be Einstein. And if you're born with 150 IQ, you're a genius. You can fluctuate a little bit, right? Change it a little bit, but not greatly. That's something that is predetermined, like the Gemara says. The Rambam says a different consideration. We're not talking about your IQ. You could be dull, dumb, but act wisely. And you could be a genius and act foolishly. Chacham o sacho is not the same thing as chacham o tipesh. One refers to IQ, that is like character traits. The other one refers to how you act wisely or foolishly, that is like behavior. That's what the Rambam's talking about. In any case, but it's still not fair, because the Rambam seems to say nothing pulls you to one side or the other, you're in total control. But is that really true? Doesn't seem fair. Let's say I have a predisposition to cruelty, and you have a predisposition to mercy. Okay, so Rambam says, well, I can control my cruelty and my mercy, and use the mercy when it's necessary, and suppress my cruelty when it's necessary. You can use your mercy when it's necessary, and suppress it when it's necessary. So we're all even. Is that really true? How many, percentage-wise, how many instances do you think where cruelty is the positive behavior and mercy is the negative behavior? I would say maybe 10% of the time. But on the other hand, where mercy is the proper behavior is probably 90% of the time. So that means that 10% of the time, I'm going to be able to use my nature and be okay. But 90% of the time, I'm going to have to go against my nature and suppress it to be okay. You, on the other hand, 10% of the time, you're going to have to suppress your nature. But 90% of the time, you're going to be able to use your nature and be okay. So is that really fair? You have a greater chance of being a tzaddik because 90% of the time, you just have to do what's natural. And I have a greater chance of being a rasha because 90% of the time, I'm going to have to suppress my natural inclination and behave against it. And that's pretty hard to do. So it's not even. It's not fair. The answer is there are three considerations. First consideration, there are many, many character traits that we all have. We don't have only one character trait. If it was only mercy or cruelty, then yeah, the guy who's more predisposed to mercy has an easier time to be a tzaddik than the guy who is predisposed to cruelty. But we have a lot of character traits, hundreds of them. So I may be more predisposed to cruelty, but I'm also generous. You're merciful, but you're stingy. So it's the opposite then. You have 90% of the time to suppress your your character trait to be good, and I only have 10% of the time to suppress it. So in the end, it evens out. With all the character traits, some people have some that are more easily used for the good, some for more easily used for the bad, and it evens out. But it doesn't always. We know some people that predominantly their character traits, not that they've worked on or anything, their character traits are basically the good ones. And some people, predominantly, they're the bad ones, meaning the ones that are more easily used for bad. What about those people? This is another factor. The Ribono Shel Olam brings you situations in life that fit your character. Because God gave you your character to, what's it called, to enhance your purpose in life. And God, therefore, knows the things that you're going to have to come against. So he gives you those situations that enable you to use your character in the best possible way. So that evens it out too. People get the situations that fit their characters. And that's what it means when it says that person doesn't get a sign that he can't handle. God gives you tests that fit your circumstances, including your character. There's one more factor, and that is God gives you a handicap. Meaning God understands and takes in consideration your personality when he gives you reward or punishment. Let's say I am more prone to anger and you're more prone to being calm. That's our nature. Okay? Somebody walks in the room and steps on both of our toes and we both lose it. We go berserk. Who's going to get punished more for losing his temper? Me or you? You. Because God knows that it's easy for me to lose my temper. That's my nature. But it's harder for you to lose your temper, and you still lost your temper. So you're going to get punished more. Who's going to get rewarded more if we both control ourselves? Me. Harder for me. So mi pum tzara agra. So God, factors into the equation your personality when he rewards or punishes you for the various things that you do or don't do based on how difficult it was for you because of your personality. So therefore, in the end, it evens out. Okay, now based on all of this, let's go back to Esav and Yaakov, and I'll tell you what I think. Esav and Yaakov were definitely different people. They were created with totally different personalities, but they weren't made to be a tzaddik and a rasha either way. They both could have been tzaddikim with their personalities, and they both could have been rishoyim. Yaakov chose to be a tzaddik, Esav chose to be a rasha, meaning the following. Theoretically speaking, okay, I have no rias to this, but there are various midrashim that we could use to present the following scenario. It's very possible that Yaakov and Esav could have both been tzaddikim, and then both of them would have been the progenitors of the Jewish people, which is not hard to understand because Yaakov Avinu had 12 sons, that all of them were shvatim, and the Jewish people came from all of them. And they also were different. So Yitzchak, there's a midrash that says Yitzchak could have had 12 sons. 12 shvatim could have come from him. But for whatever reason, it didn't happen. But he surely could have had more sons. And even though the Ribono Shel Olam said, only with Parsh of Yitzchak will your Zera, will your seed continue on with the Jewish people, but it didn't say Dafka not Esav or Dafka not Yaakov. It said part of your seed, meaning Esav and Yaakov could have been both tzaddikim, and Yitzchak could have had other children. And they would have not been the progenitors of the Jewish people. But Esav and Yaakov would have been. So there's nowhere that it says that Yaakov, Esav, could not have been a progenitor of the Jewish people had he chosen the right choices. If that's the case, then God could have given Esav the character traits that he did and Yaakov the character traits he did because the Jewish people needed both of those character traits. Because the fundamental leadership of Klal Yisrael is two leaders, a Melech and a Kohen Gadol. They're very different personality-wise. The Melech is aggressive and strong and has to be cruel because he has to destroy evil. And the Kohen Gadol's very person that's behind the scenes, holy, calm, not this aggressive, more passive or whatever. That's the Kohen Gadol. So the Ribono Shel Olam was preparing the Jewish people based on the free choice of these people, whatever. I mean, the Ribono Shel Olam knew what it was going to be. But we're second-guessing history, what could have been. Esav was supposed to develop his personality trait to be the king, the foundation of kings in Klal Yisrael, and Yaakov to be the foundation of Kohanim. and therefore they had different personalities. Nowhere, to the best of my knowledge, is there a medrash that says that every time she passed by a Beis Avodah Zarah, Esav wanted to go out and serve Avodah Zarah. Doesn't say that. Or that Yaakov wanted to go out and learn Torah. All it says is they wanted to go out, period. Doesn't say what they wanted to do. They didn't want to do anything. What it means is the following. Esav was given a personality that fit a king. Kings are involved in the physical world, basically. And being involved in the external physical world, right, is what's it called? Needs a certain personality. You have to have a certain tendency towards aggressiveness, towards what's it called? Feeling comfortable amongst physical, material things, knowing how to deal with them or whatever. So God gave him those capabilities, those tichunos, those character traits. He could have used them for the good, he could use them for the bad. So what is the most physical, material place in the world? Place where there's idolatry. Because they take spirituality and turn it into physicality. They take the spiritual world and turn it into physical. So Esav was attracted like a magnet, his personality, to that environment. But not necessarily to do something bad, he could have done something good. In fact, the Tzifzei Kohen, which is the students of the Arizal, ask a very pertinent question. It says, every time Rivka passed by a place of Avodah Zarah, Esav wanted to go out. What was Rivka doing there? You're supposed to avoid these places. What was every time she passed? It sounded like she passed by a lot of times. Say the Talmidim of the Arizal, Rivka grew up amongst idol worshippers. She knew how to deal with them. So she went to these places to mekarev people. Like Rabbi Grossman from Migdol HaEmek, right? Used to go into the discotheques or whatever and be mashpia on people, mekarev them. So that's what Rivka did. Who said that Esav couldn't have done the same thing? He was attracted to be around these places, but it could have been for the good. It could have been for the bad. It doesn't say that he had a Yetzer Hara to serve Avodah Zarah. He was attracted naturally by his very basic of his character to be around physical places. Yaakov, on the other hand, was attracted to be around spiritual places. Most spiritual places are Beis Medrash. But that doesn't say he wanted to learn. He didn't have a Yetzer HaTovah, Yetzer HaRa. He just was attracted like a magnet. Now, you can be attracted to spiritual environments and not be a tzaddik at all. Right? You can be attracted, I don't like the hustle and bustle of the world, I don't like physical, material things, right? Really change my clothes, don't take a bath, right? I would like to go up to the top of the Himalayas and sit on top of a mountain and contemplate my navel. That doesn't make you a tzaddik. Makes you very spiritual, right? Really not attracted to the physicality and materialism of the world, but you're not tzaddik. You can be attracted to the environment of a Beis Medrash. Oh, I love that. I hate to be out there in that physical world. I like the serenity of a Beis Medrash, but you never learn a word. You drink some coffee, smoke some cigarettes, talk Lashon Hara. That's your whole day, right? Never learn a word. You're not a tzaddik, but you're attracted to this kind of serene environment. So it never said that Yaakov wanted to learn or that Esav wanted to serve Avodah Zarah. Just by their nature, they were attracted to this environment. That's all. Memela, you can understand that when they were born, nobody paid attention. Rashi doesn't say there wasn't any differences, but nobody paid attention to the differences because it didn't mean anything. They just were different children. Like all children are different. Each one had his specific personality. So nobody paid attention because it wasn't good or bad, it just was different. In fact, Rav Shamshon Farlher says that when it says they both went to school and they both came home from school, that was a criticism of Rivka and Yitzchak. How could you send two different children to the same school? A school that would be good for the personality of Esav couldn't be good for the personality of Yaakov, and vice versa. They should have sent them to different schools. If the fact they sent them both to the same school, then somebody was suffering here. And somebody wasn't able then to develop properly. That's a critique on Yitzchak and Rivka, according to Rav Shamshon. In any case, so that's why nobody noticed. But when they became bar mitzvah, they already began to show behavior. What their choices were. Not just what they were personality-wise. How did they use that personality? And then people saw, this one's going to the Beis Medrash to learn, this one's going out in the field. Then they took notice. But it still didn't make Esav a Rasha, because he could have been learning Torah in the field. He could have been learning Shechita. His nature is his personality was one. He couldn't sit within four walls. He needed to be in a field school, outside, aggressive. And that's how he was preparing to be a melech. So Yitzchak Avinu saw these two children. One was my melech, and one is my Kohen Gadol. And they're both developing their personality. He's doing it in the field, hunting, and he's doing it in the Beis Medrash. But if the hunter is learning, he's saying Mishnayis, whatever, when he's out in the field, but that's his personality. That's the environment. He has to develop his personality. That's very nice till you get to age 15, like we said. And Esav is not this aggressive king, right? But he's a Rasha. He murders people. He's immoral. He's an Ovid Avodah Zarah, right? Those are pretty hefty things. Why didn't Yitzchak know that? And Avraham Avinu had to die. It was so obvious that he had to die so he shouldn't see it. So why did Yitzchak not see it? The answer is, one of them is clear, what I'm going to tell you. There's no other way out. Since one of them is so clear, the other two, you have to say something, even though it sounds like conjecture and very contrived. Which is the one that's clear? Murder. Esav committed murder, so say the rabbis. Who did he murder? Nimrod. Nimrod was the arch villain of the world. It's like somebody killing Hitler in the middle of World War II. Or somebody in Yirtzeh Hashem killing Ahmadinejad. They're not going to be a murderer. They're going to be a hero. That's what kings do. Can't you see Yitzchak Avinu saying, wow, my 15-year-old budding king already killed the biggest villain in the world. That's what kings are supposed to do. Baruch Hashem. Wow. That's not a sin. He's not a murderer. He's a hero. I said, why does Chazal say he's a murderer? Because if you murder Ahmadinejad or Hitler to rid the world of a tyrant, it's a mitzvah. But if you do it because you like his uniform, you're a murderer. Esav killed Nimrod not because he was a Rasha. He killed him because he liked his clothes. He wanted his magical clothes. That's murder. Even if you're killing Nimrod. The same thing with the other two. But Yitzchak Avinu saw what Esav did, and now he could judge him that he's a murderer and he had bad intentions, or he's a hero and he has good intentions. What's the halacha when you have such a conflict or a dilemma, a question? Don lekav zchus, halacha. You have to give him the benefit of the doubt. So he gave him. He's my budding king. This is what kings do. Same thing with the other ones. It says, Boal Nara Murasa. He had relations with an engaged woman. Now, Nara Murasa doesn't exist before the Torah was given. It never exists by Goyim. It only exists by Jews. And after the Torah was given, that there's such a thing as Kedushin. A man can make a woman married without actually having relations with her. Giving her a ring and saying her Emma Kudeshesli in front of witnesses. She's married. But a Goy, or anybody before Matan Torah, did that to a woman. She wasn't married. She's a totally unmarried woman still. Only thing that'll make her marry is having relations with her for the sake of marriage. So what status does she have? She's an unmarried woman who's engaged, like we have engagement today. Engaged means promise to be married, but there's no change in her status. So Tosfos asks in Sanhedrin, so Esav really didn't do any Avera, because this woman was not a married woman. But it wasn't nice. You don't take somebody else's prospective bride and seduce her. Even though there's no, it's not Gilui Arayos. What could Esav have thought, or at least portrayed to the world? Esav could have thought the following. Look, I know it's not nice, but it's not a real aveir. It's not nice. And this poor woman is promised to marry an idolater. If she marries him, her life is finished. She's to be an idolatress, and that's it. I'm the son of Yitzchak, the grandson of Avraham. My environment is one of belief in God. Now, if I let this woman marry the idolater, forget it. So I'm going to seduce her, and she'll marry me, or she'll be my concubine. And I'm going to bring her to a life of Torah and Yirah Shamayim. So I'm a Karifer, just Makarifer a little too close. So don't you know that there are people in the Kiruv world that make that same mistake? That cross the lines of male-female relationships in being Makarif people? Kiss and hug and whatever, the shame Kiruv? Happens. They're wrong. But in their convoluted way, they think they're doing something L'shem Shamayim. So Esav surely. And that's what a Melech does. Looking through history, good kings, they did things that were sexually very gray areas. Yehuda and Tamar, Lot and his daughters, all Malchus comes from that. Porates gather. Yehuda breaks his way through the womb. Right, they come out first. Pritzus. So Yitzchak again has a doubt. Is my son doing this with good intentions, bad intentions? Because it's not an intrinsic sin. The Torah knew he did it with bad intentions. He's a murderer, he's immoral. Yitzchak had to give him kafschus. He had a doubt. The halacha is, donim lekafschus. Same thing goes with Avodah Zarah. Maybe he served the idolatry with not the intention of really meaning it, but he wanted to infiltrate the idolatrous places so later on he could destroy them. And we know that there's people do that, double agents or whatever. And Esav says, someday I'm going to come and I'm going to have to infiltrate these places. So let me let them think that I'm on their side and eventually I will infiltrate them. So he, inside he wasn't serving any idolatry, or maybe not. Yitzchak didn't know. He had a donum lekafschus. So why did Rivka know? Why did Avram have to die? Because Yitzchak never saw a faker. He saw either evil people or righteous people. But Lot was thrown out of the house and Yishmael was thrown out of the house. Fakers he never saw. So when he saw people, Esav behaving the way he did, he had a legitimate doubt. Is he doing this proper or not? But to think that he's a faker, that didn't come into his mind. Because he didn't know that there's such a thing that people can fool the other people. So therefore, he had a legitimate doubt, and when in doubt, give the person the benefit of the doubt. But Rivka grew up amongst fakers. She knew that Esav was a faker. There was no doubt. When there's no doubt, there's no don lekafschus. Don lekafschus is only when you give somebody the benefit of the doubt, that there's no doubt to you, right? You see a guy munching on a chicken leg, you know he's 100% healthy. He's hooked up to a heart-lung machine or whatever, what's it called, sensors, and you see his heart's good, he's not, no pikuach nefesh. There's no place of the doubt. He's a Rasha. When there's doubts, then you're don lekafschus. They had no doubts. Avram also grew up with such people. He knew what fakers were. And mainly he, what's it called, knew, and he had to die. He would have seen through Esav. But Yitzchak didn't see through it. Because of halacha, because he had to be done. Lekafschus. Not just because he was naive. Because the halacha demanded that he give him the benefit of the doubt. And therefore, Yitzchak wasn't fazed by the fact that Esav didn't say please and thank you. Because what melech, you know, nice, you know, people, nebuchals, or what's it called, nice people say please and thank you. But kings don't go around saying, please, can I, you know, cut off your head or whatever. They do what they have to do. So Esav is a king in formation, so he doesn't, it's not so machbenam, please and thank you. And he doesn't mention God's name. I think the Maral, I think the Ramban says it too. Yitzchak saw that as a milah. You know why Esav doesn't mention God's name? Because most of the time he has to be in places where it's usher to mention God's name, because it's dirty and tamei. So he's machmer. And he never mentions God's name for fear of mentioning it in the wrong place. But Yaakov always mentions God's name. Why? Because he's always in good places. Why shouldn't he? But Esav's a king. Kings have to be in places of dirt and tumah. So he can't mention God's name. So he's machmer. Doesn't mention it ever. So what's left as, oh, one, and one second, my proof. How do I know that Esav had the character of Malchus? Because it says beferish that. The Gemara says there was another person in history who had the same character as Esav. David HaMelech. Admoni. But Yifei Nai. He used his character traits for the good. And Esav used them for the bad. But the character traits were the same. Same way the Torah describes Admoni, the Yifei Nai. That's how it describes David HaMelech. So you see, he had the same characteristics as David HaMelech. Now, the only problem is, why did Rivka not go to her husband and tell him? So, the answer is that Rivka knew that if she told Yitzchak that Esav was a Rasha, and he's giving him the benefit of the doubt, but it's not true. There is no doubt here. She could have convinced Yitzchak not to give Esav the brachas. Now, why did Yitzchak want to give Esav the brachas? Because what were these brachas? These are the brachas of a king. Tala shamayim, mishmanei haaretz, drove, dogad, vesirosh, materialism. Yavducha avim, yishtachavu lecha leumim, hevigvirli achecha. This is aggressive, subduing other peoples, having people bow to you. This is not the Kohen Gadol. This is the melech. So the bracha goes to the melech, not to the Kohen Gadol. Later on we'll give the Kohen Gadol brachas, but this is the brachas of the melech. But Rivka knew that Esav wasn't going to be the Melech. Nobody was going to come from him. He was Pasul. So she convinced, she could have convinced Yitzchak not to give the brachas to Esav. He's a Rasha. But she was afraid she couldn't convince him to give them to Yaakov. Because Yitzchak would say, okay, I lost my Melech. But this guy's great Kohen Gadol, right? Nice Nebuchadnezzar, sits, you know, passive, squeamish guy, sits in the base medrash. What kind of Melech could he be? What's it going to do with these brachas? So she said to Yaakov, and she convinced him he wouldn't give the bracha with a full heart. Because he would, his Melech is lost. He thought Esav to be the archetype, the perfect one. So she told Yaakov, I want you to show your father two things. One I always say, and one I just say today, because somebody told me this idea last night. I think the Malbim says it. The first thing is what Rosh Hashanah for her says. She wanted to prove to Yitzchak that Yaakov had it in him to act like Esav when it was necessary, and therefore the Malchus was going to come from him. Because even though his major personality was the Kohen, but all of Klal Yisrael was going to have to come from him, both the Malchus and the Kohuna, when it's necessary, Yaakov can fool you to thinking he's Esav. That's how good an Esav he can be. In addition, she wanted to show him that people can fool you. And you shouldn't be done them l'kaf schus because you don't understand that people are fakers. I'm going to show you that you can be fooled by somebody, and that's Esav's fooling you too. So both things she proved to him, which she couldn't have convinced him just with words. Had to see it himself. And that's what happened. What did he say? He said, the guy in front of me has the voice of Yaakov in the hands of Esav. And he blessed him because he didn't know who he was. Doesn't make any sense. Because he didn't know who he was, he should have said, time out, nothing, no, we're leaving everything the way it is till I find out what's going on over here. No. I see now that one of them can have both aspects. So it must be that it's not going to be that one aspect's going to come from one and one from the other. One of them is disqualified. And one of them, both aspects are going to come out. And therefore he gets both the brachas. Because he's an Esav and a Yaakov together. Because Yaakov can be an Esav. And it's only when Esav walked in that he saw Gehenim opened that he realized that Esav was totally disqualified. And the one who came before was Yaakov, who was going to do both things. That's the parsha. Now let me add a little bit enhancement to this. So based on all of this, we have that, theoretically speaking, Esav could have developed into the archetype Melech and been the progenitor of Malchus in Klal Yisrael, and Yaakov the perennial archetype, what's it called, Kohen Gadol, and father all the Shevet of the Kohuna. Okay? Based on that, I want to explain quite a few other things. Says that what's it called, that in the womb they split up this world and the next world. Esav got Olam Hazeh and Yaakov got Olam Haba. Now that sounds really not nice, like, you know, Esav was interested in Olam Hazeh, he's one Olam Haba, he's a Rasha. No, this world is important and the next world is important. You can't have the next world without this world. You have to go through a Gashmiyistik world and use it properly to make Olam Haba. But the Gashmiyistik world is meaningless if it's not for the sake of Olam Haba. So both are important. So instead of each one being involved totally in both, they split up the responsibility. Esav said, we are going to accept the responsibility of developing this world, creating the infrastructure, so you, Yaakov, can learn Torah and infuse the world with Kedusha. Instead of you having to waste your time with the physical world and me waste my time with directly in the spiritual world, we will take care of creating the kind of physical world that will benefit the people who are involved in the spirituality. And you won't have to be involved in that. I won't have to be involved in what you're involved in. And together, as partners, will work out very nicely. And that taka worked out once in history by Rebbe and Antoninus. Right, that's what it says. Shnei goyim avitneich, that refers to Rebbe and Antoninus. Why does it refer to Yaakov and Esav? Because by them it didn't work out. But they would be partners, like the partner of the body and the soul. The body has its part, and the soul has its part. They work together, though. The body takes care of the physical part of the world, and the soul takes care of the spiritual part, which is Olam Haba. Olam Haba is not another world. It's the spiritual neshama of this world. So, and therefore, it says, V'rav yavod tsa'ir, which can mean two things. That the older one will serve the younger one. Or Varav, the older one, will be served by the younger one. or the older one will serve the younger one. Both things are possible. And sometimes the physical is the more important, and then it leads to the spiritual. So the spiritual has to serve the physical, and sometimes the opposite. The spiritual is the most important at that point, and the physical has to be subservient to the spiritual at that point. So it works both ways, and that was the ideal. And that's why it says that Esav is compared to a chazer. Because a chazer, the simen kashrus of a chazer is its hoof, the external simen. The internal is not okay, but the external. Esav was more involved in the external world, in the physical, material world, and if he would have developed it properly, he would have gotten reward. Where do we see that? The Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Later on, the Roman Empire is going to come before God and want reward. For what? We built shopping centers, we built bathhouses, we amassed a tremendous amount of money, and everything we did that the Jewish people should learn Torah. Now, if that was true, they would have gotten reward. Because they created the Olam Hazeh, the infrastructure for the Jewish people to infuse it with Olam Haba, with Torah. And they would have gotten reward. What did God say to them? It's not true. You made the shopping centers to put your, what's it called, harlots, prostitutes, zonos. Meaning the following. What's the idea of the shopping center? Populating the world. Seeing that the world grows and all the needs of the world are taken care of. That's the population of the world. Had you done it in a way that was permissible, and you did it for the sake of a mitzvah to populate the world so the Jewish people then could learn Torah and make the world significant spiritually too. There's a big world out there, and that big world becomes spiritually significant. That's the purpose. So you're doing the physical infrastructure, and they're doing this, adding the inner spiritual part. Then you would have gotten reward as a partner. But you didn't do it. You wanted to populate the world in an immoral way. Your whole the design was like a prostitute, like a zona. It's all immoral. Your purpose of populating the world was immorality. And therefore, you don't get rewarded if the Jewish people infused it with Kedusha. It has nothing to do with you. You're not a partner. And you made merchatzos. You made bathhouses. You could have made the bathhouses to cleanse the physical world, to cleanse the body, to make it clean for what's it called, for Yaakov then to be able to use it in a way that won't taint him, to cleanse the world for him. But you didn't do it for that reason. You did it in order to adenis atzmecha, for your own personal pleasure. You did it to be marba pleasure, the opposite of nikiyas. Cleanliness, cleansing the world means to do things l'shem shamayim. That's nikiyas. And you did it bedafka for your own personal hanoah, your own personal benefit, personal enjoyment. And the money, the purpose of the money would have been to support Torah, build Torah. Kesef is Zohav. Kesef is the idea of supporting Torah, money, and Zohav is to aggrandize it, beautify it. But you didn't. Liyah Kesef, Liyah Zohav. I did that. I made that the Jewish people should be supported. You didn't have intention for that. You wanted to support and aggrandize the wrong things in this world. But had they done it with the right intention, they would have gotten rewarded. That was Esav's intention. That was Esav's what God meant. That's Malchus. Malchus is to take care of the physical world and make it fit for spirituality. And then somebody else will be involved in the spirituality. You work together as a partner. And that's why Rabbi Yehuda was Meshabeach, the Roman government. He said, look how many marketplaces they made. Look how many bathhouses they made. Look how much money they amassed. And only Rav Shimon bar Yochai said, yeah, but it's not for that purpose. It doesn't work unless they have intention to do it as a partner with the people who are involved in the spiritual part of the world. That's why Esav was pulled by a place of Avodah Zarah, an environment of Avodah Zarah. Why? Because what is Avodah Zarah? More than we said before, that's the most physical place in the world. Avodah Zarah is a totally external look at the world. All you see are the secondary causes, and you forget that there's an inner spiritual neshama to this world, which is called God. You see the external, the body of the world, which is the Avodah Zarah, all the secondary causes. So that kind of place is where he was attracted to, not bad, but because that was his role. His role was to be involved in the external things of the world. And that's why his name was Esav. Esav means osui, finished. Physically, he looked finished. He had hair. What is the external simen of maturity? Hair. What's the internal simen? Age. He had the external siman, didn't have the internal siman, right? And Esav in gematria shalom. Shalom means complete. Physically speaking, Esav was complete. But and his job was to enhance the physicality, material, external world. And it could be that for that reason, Esav was a Bechor and Yaakov was a Bechor. If twins are in the womb, the inner Bechor is Yaakov. And the external Bechor, the first one to be born, is Esav. Right? And it could be that, really it should be, that the inner Bechor is the one that is the Bechor Petarechem, the Kodesh. The one that's like the Kohen. Right? That's Petarechem, that's inside. The Rechem, the neck of the womb, is inside the body of the woman. But the one that's born first, outside, is the one that gets the what's called Pishlein, the double portion from the father. One's a material thing, and one's a spiritual thing. Could be Yaakov was the Bechor for the spiritual things, and Esav was the Bechor for the physical things. But since you couldn't know that, Esav had both, and Yaakov bought from him the rights of the spiritual Bechor. Because ultimately, he was the inner Bechor. And that's why the Beis Halevi says an interesting thing. It says, Vayetze ha-rishon. Rishon, he says, means the choice one. Ha-rishon means the first one. Esav was first. He wasn't the choice. But he's the one that needed to prepare the way for Yaakov. Before you can have spirituality, you have to have a physical world. He prepares the physical world. He's ha-rishon. And then comes the Reishis, the one that's the choice one, that's going to fill this physical world with the purpose. The goal is a spirituality, but the means is the physical world, so the means comes before the goal. So HaRishon comes before Rishon, before the Reishis. We're called Reishis. And that's why Yaakov is holding on to the heel of Esav. The heel is what sets a person physically, material, on his feet. Right, Hayakuba Shibra Aglaim. A person stands on his feet in this world, he's based in a physical way. The feet always represent the physical. Yaakov holds on to the physical world that Esav puts before him and follows that, and then what's it called, follows it up with injecting into it spirituality. And that's why Esav is Edom. Edom represents the physicality of man. He was created from the earth, which was reddish clay. That's why he's called Adam. Adam is Edom, red. The redness represents the external aspect of man and his body, right? And that's why he was concerned with the Adam ha-Adam hazeh. He knew that Avram died, and he knew they were making a meal, a sudas havra, right? A consolation meal. But he couldn't see past the fact that ha-Adam ha-Adam hazeh, the physical Avram, is dead. And thinking about mortality in that respect, that it's the end of the physical life, Esav became an apikoros. Yaakov, on the other hand, didn't just see the external red, the body. He had the lentils. The lentils had no mouth. They have no opening. That an oval has to think about the meaning of death. That it's just the physical body that's not around, but the neshama goes on somewhere else. So Yaakov got chizuk from this meal, from the avelus. Tov lalecha so beis ha'avel. Zechiras yom ha'mavis, reminding himself of the day of death, brought him to chizuk. Whereas Esav, reminding the day of death, if all you look at the externals, it's very debilitating and depressing, because there's nothing left. The body's dead. That's all there is. So he saw ha'adam ha'adam. He saw the redness of the consolation meal, meaning the total destruction of the body, which is the red. Whereas Yaakov made lentils. He saw beyond the external. He didn't have a mouth. He was able to think and contemplate and understand the significance of death that gives you chizuk, not the opposite. That's why it says, Esav said, Lama ze li bechora, ze. He could point with his finger to the external things. If all I see is the external world, what do we need a bechora for? I want now. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. I don't want to know about a Bechorah that comes after the death of my father, and I don't want to wait for it. I want immediate gratification, because who knows how much time you have in this world. If you're looking only at the external world, then you want it right now. You don't want to wait till later, because who knows if there's a later. But if you're looking at the big picture, eternity, then adarabah, then everything is later. The Iker is what's later. It's not immediate gratification now. And that's why Esav described his life, Hinei Anochi Holech Lamus, I'm on my way to die, because that's all life is. You're born, you begin to die. That's why Esav was a hunter. A hunter's out in the field, external, only wants to deal with this animal in its external way, kill it, eat it, finished. Yaakov was a shepherd, according to the Pashup Shat, the Rashbam says it. Shepherd lives in tents, inside, not out in the field. He raises the sheep for a future benefit, and he takes the inner value of the sheep, even when it's alive, the milk, and so on, right? That's a more inner and delayed benefit from the animal, not an immediate one. And that's why Esav was a faker. What's a person who can fool people? A person who can present an external view that's not really true. Doesn't have anything to do with his inside. Whereas Yaakov is ish tam. He was a perfect person who the inside, the outside were the same. He spoke the same way he thought. And therefore he's Yoshev Olam. He sat in the internal places, not out in the field, in the externals. And that's why Esav didn't mention God's name. Again, he dealt with the externals of the world. He didn't see the internal causes. He always saw with the secondary causes. Like we said, that's why he was attracted to Avodah Zarah. But it could have been used for the good. Okay? And that's why he didn't say please and thank you. What's the purpose of please and thank you? Gnaw. I was thinking, the word gnaw has two meanings. It means please, but it also means raw. Al tochlu mimenu gnaw. Why is please and raw? Because when you say please, you soften up a person's will. Right? You're appealing not to his external, but to his heart. And you're softening up his heart, which is soft meat when it's before it's cooked, is soft. It's gnaw. So Esav didn't deal with the inner will of the person. He said what he had to say to the external, and that's it. You don't have to soften up the inside. And that's why Yitzchak wanted to give the bracha to Esav. This was the bracha of the physical world. And Esav's the one who's going to develop the physical world. So why should I give it to Yaakov? So he wanted to give it to Esav. And that's why Yaakov, when he was now take the place of Esav, had to show Yitzchak that he also could deal with chitzonius, with externals, and also be a person who could fool you, meaning present the external different than the internal, because that was now he had to do both things. He had to develop the external world plus the internal world, because there wasn't going to be a partner. Everything was going to come from him. And that's why it says that Yitzchak was impressed with the smell, reyach begodav, the smell of his clothing. The clothing is the external thing, but there was an inner smell to it. He saw he could put the two things together. There's the external, but the neshama that gets enjoyment from the smell was also there. And that's why Chazal say it means reyach bogdav. He saw that there were Jews who on the outside looked like renegades, but inside they still had that pintle of yid. They came back to Judaism or whatever. Inside they were fine. So it's possible to have the external one way, the internal another way, and it's all going to come from Yaakov. And eventually the internal will affect the external. And that's why Esav was held guilty for killing Nimrod. Lechara, like we said, it's a mitzvah. It's only a mitzvah if you have the right kavana. The inside kavana makes that a mitzvah. But if you divorce the inside and you only look at it from the outside, it's murder. It's only if you have the right kavana does it make it not murder. But without the kavana, totally external ma'isa is murder. The same thing goes with Nara Murasa. On the outside, it looks bad. It looks immoral. His kavana could have been good. That would have been good, but his kavana wasn't good. He had no internal, only external. Only external doesn't look good. Avodah Zarah. You don't have it in your heart. You're not accepting it. You're infiltrating. But if your whole approach to life is external, then we judge you on externals. And externally, you're bowing down to this idol. What do I care what's in your heart? Your whole approach to life is external. And that's why Yaakov really should have filled Esav's externals with internal, ruchnias, the physical filled with spiritual. But what did Esav want from Yaakov? Halitainina, fill my inside with a bunch of food. Feed me like an animal. Force feed me. Right? He understood that Yaakov is going to have to fill up the void that he has on the inside, since he's so much involved with the outside. But he didn't want it filled up with spirituality. Fill it up with food. So Esav wasn't interested in this spirituality that Yaakov was to be his partner. He wanted Yaakov to be his partner to serve him physically, and he wanted the inside to be physical and the outside to be physical. And that's why ultimately we have Rebbe and Antoninus, because they are the partnership that should have been. Antoninus took care of the physical world, the Roman Empire, and Yaakov and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi took care of the spiritual world. And that's why it says that they never had tznon and chazeres, right? Radishes and horseradish were always on their table, winter and summer, even if it was out of season. I was thinking the idea is the following. Chazeres is morer, right? They always had the tsar of the world, and it says that tznon is a antidote for the bitterness of the morer. It's a Gemara in Psachim. That, or there's a Kol Ramaz, really, on the Mishnayah says this. Says it's known that tznon takes away the ill effect of the horseradish, where you could get, you know, harmed by the kaffa. Some people say it's a worm or some kind of poison inside. It neutralizes the poison. So the tznon is the good things that make the tzoris sweet. Now it says that the tznon is only good in the winter. It's not good in the summer, according to one opinion in Gemara and Erevin. So they always had tznon and chazeres. They always had the tzoris, but in one season they had something that made the tzoris good, and another season they had the tzoris the way that it was. Meaning, Rebbe and Antoninus were a partnership. There was a physical world, material world, and then there was a spiritual world. Sometimes it was necessary to go through tzoris in this physical world for the sake of the spiritual. And then the physical served the spiritual. And sometimes it's the opposite. The spiritual world, right, was benefited by the physical world being fine and a happy place or whatever. Then the spiritual served the physical, right? So they never had a time when there wasn't snow in Chazeres. Sometimes the Chazeres was the main thing, summer and winter, and sometimes the snow was the main thing. And, okay, so that more or less is a little bit of enhancement on this concept that had Yaakov and Esav both done what they were supposed to do, they would have been partners, Melech and Kohen Gadol. But in another dimension, this world, the external physical world, and the internal spiritual world, which is really the Kohen Gadol is the leader of the internal spiritual world, and the Melech is the leader of the external physical world.